Thank y'all. Well, we'll pick up in the middle of chapter 14 of Mark and move over into 15 this evening as we approach Easter and as the gospel approaches the Easter moments here in 14 and 15. Last time, as we were ending, Jesus had gone in with the disciples to the upper room. He had semi-revealed the betrayer. He said, the betrayer is one who is dipping bread with me. One of the Gospels says that at that moment in time, Judas was actually dipping the bread. He had given it to him, and he was dipping the bread. But here he talks about, and we talked a little bit last time about, you know, woe be unto the man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It'd be better for him if he had not been born, whatever that might mean. And we talked about how he broke the bread with them, he drank with them, and that was part of the Passover meal. But he added, instead of just physical freedom, which was the Passover celebration, he added to that spiritual freedom and everlasting life. And then they go to Gethsemane, where, after Peter says, "No, I'll never deny you," they go to Gethsemane, where Jesus agonizes three different times over whether to die or not. And at that point, immediately while he was still speaking, Judas came, one of the 12, and with him a crowd with swords and clubs from the chief priests and the scribes and the elders, starting in verse 43. Now, on Wednesday mornings the last couple of weeks, we've been looking at the Gospel of John related to the meal and related to the betrayal and trial and crucifixion. And in the Gospel of John, we are told by that writer that it's not just here in Mark, it just sounds like that it's temple guards. And it's soldiers hired by the temple priests. And there were temple guards there that went with the high priest, the chief priests, and others, and also stood guard around the temple, especially to keep Gentiles from wandering in who were not proselytes, to keep women from wandering in because they weren't supposed to get into the temple area. Okay. Well, go ahead.
When you were saying, were you praying, where to die or not?
Yes. Three times. If he didn't have a choice, then it wasn't a temptation. He doesn't know what we face. But he prays three times, "Father, if there's any other way." So he wants another way out from dying.
Okay.
Right.
But he didn't really have a choice.
Well, he could have. If we take away his ability of chosen, then there's a lack of his humanity there. He knew what needed to be done. But as, you know, living as a human and facing life as we humans do, you know, 33, 34 years old, he knew that if he was going to die, how it would be at the hands of the Romans. And so in this moment of humanity and human weakness, he shows that he's been there no matter what we face. It's not just the other temptations, but no matter what we face, he's been there and he's had to make the difficult decision. In his humanity, he chose to be limited, to live life like we, and to have that choice. Now, the important thing, two important things. One, he had a choice, and two, he made the choice that he made. But he had the choice to die or not, because he says, if there's any other way, and let this cup pass from me, that kind of thing. It's just like... But in the moment, in the moment of agony and agonizing over that, and he had to make, the interesting thing is, you know, he wants the disciples to sit and watch and pray, but he finds them asleep. Well, that also means, you know, he had to make the decision himself. They couldn't make it for him. Just like we, you know, we can have people to lead us and guide us and teach us, but ultimately it's our decision. It's not a parent's decision. It's not a grandparent's decision. It's not a best friend's decision. It's our decision whether to follow or not. And it's just like on the cross. Matthew and Mark are the two that raise that interesting question, my God, why have you forsaken me or forgotten me? The word means forsaken and it also means forgotten. At that particular point, that shows the humanity, that along with thirst. I thirst. I'm thirsty. Well, y'all may know if you've seen people die. I know from seeing far too many people die that one of the common threads among most is before they reach that point, they get dry and parched and thirsty. And that's a sign that things are starting to shut down.
Do you not think he knew what was going to happen after he died?
I think that he died with that prayer, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit, counting on God, knowing that God was going to raise him. But I also think in that moment, the human side of him, the human part of him, shows. Yes.
We know what's going to happen when we die, but
right.
We don't know what's going to die.
Oh, no. Well, and what's really interesting is studies have been done, and I've said this before, studies have been done, and actually the people who spend the most money to try and stay alive are the people who are Christian, not the people who are unbelievers. You know, when you get in the hospital, we spend more money. People who claim to be believers spend more money to try and stay alive than people who don't.
Why?
I don't know. That's a good question. I think it's part of our humanity and part of our wanting to hang on. But, you know, but I've also, what's really interesting, Susan, is I have people who have been staunch believers all their lives, and they get to that point of death and they're afraid that they haven't lived up enough. And we talk about that, and, you know, it's not living up enough, it's doing with, you know, but.
That's what you were talking about in the lesson this morning when people are on deathbed and they say, I wish I had done this.
Yeah. Yeah.
To make more money, but to do more Christian-like things.
Right.
I actually believe the exorcist coming. I remember my dad, we advised the boy, he kept saying, bring that light closer. Remember that? Bring that light closer, you know, you see.
Praise God.
Right. Yes, sir. But. You know, unless we get to that point and suddenly we get to thinking, well, there's all this stuff we want to do and there's stuff that we should do, but people who claim to be believers on average spend more money on the machines and other things to keep alive than folks who don't. But I really don't know why. It is.
Self-preservation is about the most strongest thing you can have.
But, you know, self-preservation and wanting to spend more time with, you know, and not wanting to miss, what am I going to miss here, or what are my grandkids going to miss, or what, you know, those kinds of things. But it is a will, and I tell folks when people get to the agonal breathing stage, I mean, even physically, that's that brainstem not wanting to give up, even when the rest of the faculties are gone.
Well, I think most people that are dying are not thinking about their self.
They think about. And I think that's a strong drive, not ready to leave the family. But why? It depends. I don't know why, but we spend more money than other folks. Now. And here we're just told this in the Gospel of John. John says that there was a contingent of Roman soldiers who also came along with the temple guards and the Pharisees. So that's where we get, not from Mark, but that's where we get an understanding that there were Roman soldiers there as well as the temple guard. Pilate doesn't want this to go, the religious leaders don't want this to go awry. They want some Roman witness to all this, so it's not just their word with Pilate. Jim?
You mentioned that Christians spend more money. Would that be because they know God could
for some, it could be. In the Gospel of John, John and Mark agree a lot until you get to some of these key points. Here, the text says, the betrayer had given them a sign saying, the one I shall kiss is the man. Seize him and lead him away under guard. And when he came, he went up at once and said, Rabbi, or Master. And he kissed him and they laid hands on him. It was a kiss on the cheek, a sign of ultimate respect. In the Gospel of John, he doesn't go anywhere near Jesus. In the Gospel of John, Jesus initiates the conversation. So, once again, different authors, different viewpoint. As Jesus says, who are you looking for? And they tell him, well, I'm right here. And Judas stays back. But here we've got this betrayal, as Mark records, and it's a betrayal of respect. what's really interesting is he betrays one, and that's also another reason why, and a dollar gets you drink machine, why I don't think Judas ever intended for Jesus to die. And I don't think he ever intended for the money to go in his pocket. And in Matthew, he tries to buy him back. I think that Judas was probably a zealot who thought Jesus was going to be the political guy he was looking for. All the way back to Isaiah 9. Upon the throne of David and over his kingdom and rule and reign with justice and righteousness from this time forth and forevermore.
Did he want him replaced by somebody? I mean, in other words, he just wanted him to be gone. If he didn't want his death, he said, well, let's get another guy.
I really think that Judas, coming from Kerioth, which was a haven for zealots, I really think that Judas thought if he put Jesus in the right position where you're either going to die or prove who you are, that Jesus would prove who he was. And then Judas would be his right-hand man because, hey, look, I helped you get here.
Well, there goes James and John.
That kind of thing. They laid hands on him and seized him, but one of those who stood by drew his sword and struck the slave off the high priest and cut off his ear. And Jesus tells them, day after day, I was teaching in the temple and you didn't seize me, let the scriptures be fulfilled. And everybody took off. All the disciples take off. Now, in the Gospel of John, we're told it's Simon Peter. In Matthew and Mark and Luke, we're just told the sword's used. Luke's the only one that has Jesus actually heal the ear. Of course, then Luke's a doctor, right? And so they all forsook him and fled. And a young man followed him with nothing but a linen cloth about his body, and they seized him, but he was wearing his tearaway jersey that day. He left the linen cloth and ran away naked. Why is that there? Don't have a real clue. Speculation is perhaps if the John Mark who is the scribe of Simon Peter is the John Mark that some tradition says grew up in the house in which the Last Supper was taking place, this might have been his way of saying he followed along to see what was going on. I didn't see it all, but I was there and took off, but we really don't know. This is strange. None of the other Gospels mention this. But the preponderance of witnesses, and once again, Mark, by including this, whoever or whatever it was, who's he writing to, or to whom is he writing? He's writing to people who are persecuted, people who are under threat of arrest, people who are under threat of death, and even in those moments, everybody runs away, so what are you going to do? That's the implicit question to his hearers. What are you going to do? And they led Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests and elders and scribes were assembled. And Peter had followed him at a distance into the courtyard of the high priest. And he was sitting with the guards and warming himself at the fire. Once again, another difference in John. You've got two disciples that go along with the crowd. And one of them goes inside the area of the high priest and talks to him and then comes back out and gets Peter and brings him in by the fire. Presumably, Judas. That would be the one that would be known by them because it doesn't say who it says, but one of the disciples who was known by the high priest. So that would have gone back to his handing them over. But in both instances, we do find, and we all know, that Simon Peter, when he's got the opportunity to stand up, even though he said, I'll die first, he denies Jesus before the cock crows twice. The cock crowed, the rooster would crow when it first started getting a little bit of light, and it would crow again when the sun came up. And so in that short span, Peter denies three times. In fact, the last time he utters a curse. But we go on. The chief priests and whole council sought testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they found none. For many bore false witness against him, their witness did not agree. And some stood up and bore false witness against him, saying, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another not made with hands. Yet not even so did their testimony agree. Now, quickly, and we've mentioned this some years back, but quickly, in the rules of the Sanhedrin, when it came to a capital offense trial, first of all, the defense always got to start. There is no defense. Secondly, it's not a capital offense trial is not to continue after sundown, nor is it to begin at sundown. These are the rules, the laws of the Sanhedrin, the rules by which to judge folks. We're talking sometime after midnight can't get much more after sundown than that. Three, there must be a minimum of two, but preferably three witnesses to agree in every detail to describe the charges. We're told they had many witnesses and none of them could agree in detail. Four, a person on trial for their lives, a capital offense crime, according to the rules of the Sanhedrin, cannot be put to death. They can be punished severely, but cannot be put to death based solely upon their admission. If suddenly they get a guilty conscience and they fess up in front of the court and say, you know, I can't stand it anymore, I did it, the court can have them severely punished, but cannot have them killed, according to the laws of the Sanhedrin. Jesus is condemned on what? His answer to one question. Are you the Son of the Blessed? And he says, I am. And immediately, Caiaphas makes his tailor happy. He tears his clothes. So now his tailor gets to repair them. And he declares blasphemy. Additionally, if a guilty verdict is reached in a capital offense crime, there is a second trial held the next day after that verdict to confirm the first verdict, to make sure they come out at the same place. Now, all of these are listed in the laws or the rules concerning the Sanhedrin for capital offense crimes. Slightly different for non-capital offense crimes. They do not hold another trial. They take him after sunrise to Pontius Pilate. So in all of this, they've already decided the verdict. They just need to come up with some way of saying, now we can take him here. And so while not all the Sanhedrin would have been there, because I do not see Nicodemus or Joseph of Arimathea, both of whom are secret followers of Jesus, both of whom go to get Jesus' body after he dies, I imagine that probably Caiaphas knew some things and invited only those that he knew he would get that kind of vote out of, in spite of the fact that in Jesus of Nazareth, the Franco Zeffirelli several hour version, James Mason is Nicodemus, and he says to Anthony Quinn, who is Caiaphas, untie him, let him answer our questions. I doubt very seriously that happened, because the text says they all condemned him to die. And why would they condemn him to die, Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea, and then turn around and go get his body? And according to tradition, they were followers. They had become followers of Jesus and his message. But this... they can't kill them, but they have to come up with a reason for the Romans to do so. And if the first step to that is for them to condemn him, then they've got to come up with other charges, because the Romans don't care about blasphemy. No. And so they come up with three charges according to Luke, not in Mark, but in Luke. Forbidding taxes to Caesar. Kind of think they missed that one.
They didn't do that.
No. Inciting the crowds to riots. They got boisterous and they cheered him coming into town and all that kind of stuff. And they loved him when he turned over the money tables and the money started scattering. And claiming to be a king, which was treason or sedition. That's the charge that Jesus is crucified by the Romans. That's the charge that sticks, as we know. And so, we find, again, the high priest asked him. I mean, Jesus was silent. Again, the high priest asked him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" Had Jesus been quiet, nothing they could have done. Jesus said, "I am." Ego, I, me. I am. Which is, if you were to go to the Septuagint, Greek translation of the Old Testament, when the text, when God says to Moses, "Tell them, I am, Yahweh sent me," the Greek version is, "Tell them, ego, I, me." Not let go my ego, but ego I me. I am. So this here, Jesus is admitting not just that he is Son of God, he is saying, ego, I, me, that is, I am. He is equating himself with God. And you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. And that's when the high priest Caiaphas tears his robes and says, we don't need witnesses. You've all heard this. What's your decision? And they all condemned him, deserving death. And it's at that point that his torture and persecution begins at the hands of the religious leaders. They start spitting on him, which was a sign of absolute disgust. They cover his face and start striking him, saying, okay, prophesy. In other words, if you're really Messiah, if you're really a prophet, tell us who hit you. Tell us who hit you. And then we have the story of Simon Peter, who denies him, and then the rooster crows. And if I were filming, but Zeffirelli did it first, but if I were filming it, if you remember the scene in that movie, as Peter denies the third time and the rooster crows, Jesus is walking by and looks him dead in the eye, being led away and looks him dead in the eye. Peter runs off, and the text says that he broke down and wept. Now, it's close to the morning, though. Remember, the rooster crows, and then the rooster crows again. And so it's early in the morning, and we do know that Pontius Pilate, from other sources, not biblical sources, but other sources, Pontius Pilate tended to hold court early in the day. In other words, only if you're serious are you going to bring somebody there just after daybreak. And he wants to get it over with. That's when he would typically hold court. He wants to get things over with so he can go on and about whatever else he wants to do during the day. So he didn't hold court later in the day. He typically held court first thing in the morning. This is, according to Mark, after the Passover. So there's not really a large crowd at this time of the morning that's gathered. But those who are interested, including the Sanhedrin and folks that they have roused up to come. And so early in the morning, the chief priests with the elders and scribes hold a consultation, and basically this is when they say, okay, what charge can we get him on for the Romans? And they tie him up and they take Jesus to Pontius Pilate. Now, we get different visions of Pontius Pilate, and he may have been conflicted, I don't know, from the gospel writers. We do know that Pilate typically was pretty much ruthless. There were other times where he didn't even think twice about sending troops into an unarmed mob and just have them mop up whoever's there. But here, he's at least seemed somewhat sympathetic. They take him, they deliver him to Pilate, and Pilate asked him, are you the king of the Jews? Which means they've told him he's a king. He says he's a king. So we know at least that charge that they're giving is true. From their perspective. And Pilate says, so are you king? Well, obviously he's not asking if he's king of the Romans, because what is he? He's Jewish. So are you the king of the Jews? And he says, well, you said so, which probably didn't thrill Pilate, because he said, well, that's what you say. But the chief priests are gathered nearby. Now, this would have been outside Pilate's quarters. They would not have gone in, because once again, this is Passover time, and they're getting ready. On that evening will be Sabbath, and if they go inside, in fact, if they get any closer than a couple of arms distance from Pilate, this Gentile, they're unclean. But they're outside, and immediately the chief priests accuse him of many things, and Pilate said, don't you have an answer? Listen to all the charges, but Jesus didn't say anything else, so Pilate wondered. In fact, in all of this, Pilate's pretty shrewd. He understands. He knows what's going on. He knows that these guys, for some reason, are trying to get rid of this guy. Now, we're told here at the feast, he used to release for them one prisoner. While that happened on occasion, it was not a regular. We do know from other writings it was not a regular occurrence. Just occasionally would the Roman procurator decide to do this. Kind of as an act of faith, good faith, sometimes to try and avoid riots. Okay, well, you know, I got two folks here. Who do you want? Kind of thing. Depending on gauging the crowd and seeing who's got the most followers there, who's got the loudest folks there. Now, Mark doesn't tell us. We do find Luke tells us the story of Herod Antipas, who is there in the city, and Jesus gets sent to him. But Mark doesn't give us that. He jumps quickly, but remember, this is Mark who's very fast-paced and trying to get to the end of the gospel here. And among the rebels in prison who had committed murder in the insurrection, there was a man called Barabbas. That simply means Bar, son of Abbas. That's how he was known. Probably a zealot, had committed murder in the insurrection. In other words, he had probably, most likely he had killed a Roman soldier, at least. But he was a pretty unsavory character anyway. And so Pilate really says, who we got down there in the dungeon? Who's the worst guy we got down there? Okay, bring him up. And he says to the people who are gathered, okay, who do you want in the neighborhood? What kind of neighborhood do you want? Like Mr. Rogers or something on the south side of Chicago? Yeah. Who do you want? Do you want Barabbas, who is a murderer and a thief? Or do you want Jesus, who talks about a kingdom that's a kingdom of love and peace and grace and all that kind of, I mean, who would you rather have out in your neighborhood? Do you want me to release for you the king of the Jews? For he perceived it was out of envy the chief priests had delivered him up. Now remember, the chief priests are Sadducees. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd to have him release for them Barabbas instead. So we end up then with whatever crowd is there. Now, not everyone in the crowd, because I'm sure the women were there. We know the women were there that had followed Jesus. Not everyone in the crowd was cheering for that. But those who were there at the behest of the chief priests had louder voices. And a squeaky wheel gets the grease, right? In Matthew, we have more banter back and forth. You know, the people say, you know, let his blood be on us. But here, it's just rather quickly. And so they cry out, what shall you have me do then with a man? And I don't know who was more surprised, really. Pilate or Barabbas? I mean, if you were Barabbas and you're out there and you're being compared with this Jesus, you know, you figure it's over. It's over. Somebody go ahead and shoot me. So I don't know who was more surprised, Barabbas. Once again, what an Anthony Quinn that played Barabbas in the movie. He gets around, doesn't he? Or he did. Or Pontius Pilate, because I guarantee you, Pilate had no clue that they would choose Barabbas over Jesus. I mean, in his mind, he'd rather have Jesus out there than Barabbas. And so he says, all right, I'll turn him loose. Well, then what do you want me to do with this man? And they said, crucify him. They said, why? What did he do to you? But they cry again, Styrake, crucify. So Pilate, wishing to satisfy the crowd, released Barabbas, having scourged Jesus, delivered him to be crucified. Now, we've talked about the scourging before. Cat of nine tails, metal bone, that kind of thing embedded in it, and then forcing the person to carry the crossbeam, which weighed about 125 pounds, to the place of crucifixion.
Do you think Pilate doesn't want to please the upper crust of the Jews also, let them know they don't have that much power? He does.
Oh, I think he's thumbing it in their nose, or thumbing his nose in their faces as well. But at the same time, I really don't think Pilate wanted to do that. I think Pilate wanted them to say, turn him loose. The crowd say, turn him loose. And they say, see? And turn him loose. And then he sent Barabbas back and had Barabbas killed.
And he's almost asking Jesus-like questions to these people. You know, like what let him out
first
stone or something along that line.
Well, he probably is figuring that there are more rabble rousers in the crowd that would like to see Barabbas released, and by giving them this choice, he figures they'll choose Jesus And anybody that starts pitching a fit about Barabbas, he can have them squashed, because he's not standing out there by himself. He's got a contingent of soldiers standing around with spears and bows and swords and all that kind of stuff. And so he has Jesus scourged. Scourging was typically reserved for folks that were going to be crucified, because it weakens them. It was a public thing. They did not generally eviscerate them like in Mel Gibson's Passion, and they certainly didn't whip them for 15 to 20 minutes like is on the screen. But it was a pretty horrific kind of thing, and then the person is forced to carry that crossbeam to the place of crucifixion, where they are nailed in a variety of ways. Of course, we've talked before, not through the hand, but either through the wrist or the fatty part of the thumb through the wrist, because the hand then won't come off. If it's top of the feet, one on top of the other, let you live longer, because you can breathe, and then you go down and everything, and then you push up and breathe. Although at an archaeological dig back in the 20th century, I find at Gibeah HaMivtar, the feet were still nailed together in that crucifixion victim, and you know the spike was through both ankle bones, and they were still on it. But it was a pretty horrific way to die. By the way, anybody remember, we've said it before, anybody remember who probably gave us crucifixion, the first people to give us hanging people on a tree?
Peter?
No, she didn't do it. She wasn't there.
I know that there were a lot of crosses. I don't know how many, but the Romans just lined them up.
Yeah, they would. So they perfected it. They hang people for whatever, and
every day.
Yeah, and when
it was a unique punishment, it was a common punishment.
Common, and it was also a deterrent for crime. That's why you paraded the circuitous route.
Because, you know, I thought, well, Jesus was the one known to crucify. There were just many, 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 many people.
And that movie Spartacus showed them lined up like lampposts.
Yeah. Well, what happened when Jerusalem falls? And Josephus writes about it, but others do too. Josephus sometimes made himself look better than he really was. But Josephus talked about the fall of Jerusalem. They ran out of crosses. The Romans ran out of crosses, and they started nailing people to the walls of the city that were still standing and to the walls of homes and that kind of stuff. Josephus came through 3 days later and found two of his friends still alive. One of them died shortly after he took him down. The other one he nursed back to health. But, you know, it's basically death by suffocation. If they do it right, you suffocate, and the average crucifixion victim lasted 12 to 18 hours with, you know, filling up cardiopulmonary sac. The pericardium fills up with fluid, heart pumps more. Congestive heart failure, your lungs start filling up with fluid from the bottom up because you can't breathe, and after a while, you just all those muscles tighten. But back to the other question, the same people who gave us a basis for our alphabet, the Phoenicians are also the first people we know that hung people on trees.
All that part of the world, though, is incredibly cruel.
Oh, yes.
I mean, all of us.
Yeah.
For every generation, if you watch it, until yeah. I mean, the different ones that did any kind of ruling.
Right. Well, the Assyrians were especially bad. The Assyrians not only came through, they had a scorched earth policy. They would cut down what they needed, and then they'd cut down the rest of the trees and burn them up so that the people left behind could barely scrape by because, you know.
I don't think we really understand. I mean, we
no.
Well, in our society, what we talk about is humane. I don't even know how we can handle living in that world.
Well, and we couldn't. The Assyrian army, when they marched and came through and conquered, not only when they conquered Israel, but when they continued to march to the west, there are accounts not just from others, but the Assyrians themselves. They would go in and they would kill the men, they would kill the women, and they were known to cut open the pregnant women, pull the fetus or the baby out, and kill it too. I mean, it's going to die with the mother, but they'd pull it out and skewer it with a sword or cut it apart.
I think nothing is saying kill all the baby babies. I mean, kill all the male babies.
Yeah.
Go out and start killing babies.
Yeah, the Egyptians, Pharaoh, that kind of thing. So it was, and in many ways still is, in areas are very cruel. I mean, we're talking.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. But the Romans perfected it. The Romans perfected, they knew how to get the most out of crucifixion and keep the person alive the longest and suffer the most. Now when they give, and actually the wine mixed with myrrh, which I think is interesting that, you know, the Magi, one of the gifts according to Matthew was myrrh, and myrrh had anesthetic qualities to it. It was used for other things, but also had anesthetic qualities. They would sometimes mix a little bit of myrrh with wine or really stout, soured wine. They would put it on a branch of hyssop, which really is sponge-like and soaks it up and then let the person drink it. It's kind of, I often say it was their one shot at trying to be somewhat humane in an inhumane situation. Yes, we're going to kill you horribly. Yes, you're going to die a horrible death. Here's something to take the edge off. So, you know, that, and Jesus knew when he was in the garden and made that decision, yes, I'm going to go through with it, what you want, not necessarily what at this moment I want. Jesus knew that would be the kind of death that he would face. Yes. Yes. Well, even makes kosher laws merciful. Kosher laws when it comes to animals has to do with the way they're slaughtered. And it's not boom, it's cut the throat a certain way and let them bleed out. So the soldiers lead him away inside the palace. They call together the whole battalion. They put him in a purple cloth, plait a crown of thorns, and put it on him, began to salute him, "Hail, King of the Jews," and struck his head with a reed, spat upon him, knelt down in mock homage to him. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him, put on his own clothes, and led him out to crucify him. By the way, the thorns, you know, are the big long things. I tell folks, if you ever want to get an idea, look at a pyracantha bush. It's kind of like that. It's kind of like that. Well, and the other day, see, I don't like riding four-wheelers. I'd rather walk. But in order to get around Friday morning, I was in the woods, and had I not been riding a four-wheeler, that, and a little spot right there, the thing on the front of the four-wheeler to knock down spider webs, well, it hit that sawbriar, and that thing came back and said, it didn't feel good. But you fall in sawbriars, that doesn't either. But, I mean, we're talking pyracantha, or look at a full-grown Bradford pear. You know, stickers kind of like that. Bradford pears eat up inflated balls. That kind of thing. And mashed it down into his head and mock him. And then they lead him out. And that on the way, Jesus falls and they compel a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who is coming from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross. Now, tradition says, who in the world are Alexander and Rufus? Tradition says that Alexander and Rufus later became Christians after their father saw this, and they later became Christians, and they helped to lead the church in Cyrene. Don't know if that's true or not. That's just what church tradition says. But the fact that it mentions Alexander and Rufus here, that Mark mentions that, and John Mark, according to tradition and according to Coptic Christianity, Egyptian Christianity, the founder of the Christian church in Egypt was supposedly John Mark. He's their patron saint, that kind of thing. And it was a Coptic church in Malden, large Coptic church in Malden. Smaller offshoot of that up towards Traveler's Rest. But so he's forced to carry the cross, and they bring him to the place called Golgotha, which means the place of a skull. Supposedly, the caves in the side of this hill, if you looked at it at a certain time, reminded folks of a skull. And by the way, this would have been, once again, this would have been these crosses lined up on the public thoroughfare as people are coming into town, because public execution, and the sign hanging up says, okay, come here, have a good time. But if you do something like this or this or this, this is where you could end up. And in some places in the Middle East, they still occasionally have public executions. A guy that I knew years and years ago had served as a military chaplain in the Middle East, actually in, was it Iran? It was either Iran or Iraq. I can't remember which one. But he was with military forces, and he said, and this was before we had fallouts with Saddam and the Ayatollah and that kind of stuff. And he said there were certain crimes that they would actually come through the villages around and round up people and take them and make them stand around the town square to watch an execution. And then would remind them, if you do this, this is where you will be. And you can imagine your pilgrims on the way in and out of Jerusalem here at Passover, and you pass by and you've got these crosses lined up here across the hill. It would be something of a deterrent, I would think.
Sound like we need them today.
And they offered him wine mingled with myrrh. Mark says he didn't take it. We find over in one of the other Gospels that he does. And they crucified him and divided his garments among them, casting lots for them to decide what each should take. And it was the third hour when he was crucified, 9 o'clock in the morning. So from the time of going before Pontius Pilate to the time of actual crucifixion is just a matter of a few hours. They gambled for his robe. It was a seamless robe, which was not all that common. It was considered a prize. And B, probably to see who could own this piece and say, well, you remember that guy over there? Well, he used to have this, and now it's mine, kind of thing. But they gamble for that robe. The inscription of the charge read, King of the Jews. Now, we do know in Matthew, the religious leaders complain about that. But Pilate says, I've written what I've written. And they're not about to push in too far because, guess what? They could end up out there. And they don't want to do that. And then you've got the thieves, two robbers, one on the right, one on his left. Some translations and some Greek manuscripts include the verse, verse 28. This is 27, and my translation jumps to 29 because it's not in the oldest manuscripts. And the scripture was fulfilled, which says, he was reckoned with transgressors.
I want to ask you something about the robbers. That,
yes.
One version, aren't there three versions? And one of the robbers is given salvation, but the another version, the two of them are both against him, or something like that?
In Luke... one of the robbers, begins to rant and rave at Jesus and says, if you really are who you say you are, why don't you get yourself down and us with you? Well, he's not worried about Jesus getting down. He just wants to know, if you can get me down, get me down. And the other one, is one who defends Jesus and says, in Luke, and says, you need to be quiet. We deserve to be here. He hadn't done anything to be here. And then, so he defends Jesus, and then he says, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And that's when Jesus says, today, or literally from this day, you will be with me in paradise.
Right. But then what was the other verse? I thought he didn't say that. Jesus didn't say, you will be with me in paradise. I thought they both went the evil way, so to speak.
No. And here it just says there are two of them there. And neither one of them says anything in this version. But once again, Mark's trying to get to, it's not these guys, it's the religious leadership and the Romans who were doing all of this kind of stuff. Those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, aha, you who would destroy the temple building in 3 days, save yourself, come down from the cross now. Now that would have been the witnesses and the members of the Sanhedrin. In Du Bois' Seven Last Words, did it one year at Boulevard, and I still remember. And every time I read this, I decided, I know it surprises you, but I decided on purpose. I had the tenor solo, and in one part it says, and wagging their heads, they said, and then the men break into, va, va, and, If you be Jesus, son of the of the Father, save yourself, you know, come down from the cross. And so at the dress rehearsal, I decided to sing. And wagging their tails, they said, because I thought about that. It was difficult the rest of that rehearsal for very many of us to get through that section. Stephen Ponder about dropped his teeth. He wasn't thrilled, but hey, and I know that surprises you, but not really. But, you know, they're, and this wagging their heads, they're shaking their heads and they're kind of shaking their fingers at the same, said, you said you were going to do this. Well, do it. Prove it. Get off the cross. Come down now. Also, the chief priest mocked him and the scribes, saying he saved others, but he cannot save himself. Not only are they mocking him, they're trying to say around to all the people around, look at where he is. Follow him. Guess what? You can end up the same way. Yes. In all the Gospels, in the Gospel of John, only one disciple is there. It says the disciple whom he loved, whoever that might be. In all the Gospels, y'all are there. The women. The women are the ones at the foot of the cross. The women are the ones that are wailing and weeping because all the guys are hiding. But part of that is self-preservation. Part of that, the guys, you know, they're not going to do anything to the women. They're going to make fun of them, shoo them off. But if the guys are there, they might arrest them and do the same thing. And it's 5 minutes till seven. Next Sunday evening, we will pick up, and the sixth hour came and darkness covers the land, and go through the remainder of the gospel through 16:8, which is where it ends in the oldest manuscripts. The finish of the crucifixion and that resurrection in the Gospel of Mark. So, thank you all. Have a good night. Be careful. God bless you. Go in peace.